and the clients were carefully screened. No drunken man was permitted to go up to them. Every 6 months, each girl was given 1 month of vacation to get drunk and raise hell. On the job, let a girl be disobedient to the rules, and Mr. Edwards personally stripped her, gagged her, and horsewhipped her within an inch of her life. If she did it again, she found herself in jail, charged with vagrancy and public prostitution. The two-week stands had another advantage. Many of the girls were diseased, and a girl had nearly always gone away by the time her gift had incubated in a client. There was no one for a man to get mad at. Mr. Hallam knew nothing about it, and Mr. Edwards never appeared publicly in his business capacity. He had a very good thing in his circuit. The girls were all pretty much alike, big, healthy, lazy, and dull. A man could hardly tell there had been a change. Charles Trask made it a habit to go to the inn at least once every 2 weeks, to creep up to the top floor, do his quick business, and return to the bar to get mildly drunk. The Trask house had never been gay, but lived in only by Charles, it took on a gloomy, rustling decay. The lace curtains were gray. The floors, although swept, grew sticky and dank. The kitchen was lacquered, walls, windows, and ceiling with grease from the frying pans. The constant scrubbing by the wives who had lived there and the biannual deep-seated scourging had kept the dirt down. Charles rarely did more than sweep. He gave up sheets on his bed and slept between blankets. What good to clean the house when there was no one to see it? Only on the nights when he went to the inn did he wash himself and put on clean clothes. Charles developed a restlessness that got him out at dawn. He worked the farm mightily because he was lonely. Coming in from his work, he gorged himself on fried food and went to bed and to sleep in the resulting torpor. His dark face took on the serious expressionlessness of a man who was nearly always alone. He missed his brother more than he missed his mother and father. He remembered, quite inaccurately, the time before Adam went away as the happy time, and he wanted it to come again. During the years, he was never sick, except, of course, for the chronic indigestion, which was universal and still is with men who live alone, cook for themselves, and eat in solitude. For this, he took a powerful purge called Father George's Elixir of Life. One accident he did have in the third year of his aloneness. He was digging out rocks and sledding them to the stone wall. One large boulder was difficult to move. Charles pried at it with a long iron bar, and the rock bucked and rolled back again and again. Suddenly he lost his temper. The little smile came on his face, and he fought the stone as though it were a man, in silent fury. He drove his bar deep behind it and threw his whole weight back. The bar slipped, and its upper end crashed against his forehead. For a few moments he lay unconscious on the field, and then he rolled over and staggered, half-blinded, to the house. There was a long, torn welt on his forehead from hairline to a point between his eyebrows. For a few weeks his head was bandaged over a draining infection, but that didn't worry him. In that day, pus was thought to be benign, a proof that a wound was healing properly. When the wound did heal, it left a long and crinkled scar. And while most scar tissue is lighter than the surrounding skin, Charles's scar turned dark brown. Perhaps the bar had forced iron rust under the skin and made a kind of tattoo. The wound hadn't worried Charles, but the scar did. It looked like a long finger mark laid on his forehead. He inspected it often in the little mirror by the stove. He combed his hair down over his forehead to conceal as much of it as he could. He conceived a shame for his scar. He hated his scar. He became restless when anyone looked at it, and fury rose in him if any question was asked about it. In a letter to his brother, he put down his feeling about it. "It looks," he wrote, "like somebody marked me like a cow. The damn thing gets darker. By the time you get home, it will maybe be black. All I need is one going the other way, and I'd look like a papist on Ash Wednesday." I don't know why it bothers me. I got plenty of other scars. It just seems like I was marked. And when I go into town, like to the inn, why, people are always looking at it. I can hear them talking about it when they don't know I can hear. I don't know why they're so damn curious about it. It gets so I don't feel like going into town at all. Adam was discharged in 1885 and started to beat his way home. In appearance, he had changed little. There was no military carriage about him. The cavalry didn't act that way. Indeed, some units took pride in a sloppy posture. Adam felt that he was sleepwalking. It is a hard thing to leave any deeply routined life, even if you hate it. In the morning, he awakened on a split second and lay waiting for reveille. His calves missed the hug of leggings, and his throat felt naked without its tight collar. He arrived in Chicago, and there, for no reason, rented a furnished room for a week, stayed in it for 2 days, went to Buffalo, changed his mind, and moved to Niagara Falls. He didn't want to go home, and he put it off as long as possible. Home was not a pleasant place in his mind. The kind of feelings he had had there were dead in him, and he had a reluctance to bring them to life. He watched the falls by the hour. Their roar stupefied and hypnotized him. One evening he felt a crippling loneliness for the close men in barracks and tent. His impulse was to rush into a crowd for warmth, any crowd. The first crowded public place he could find was a little bar, thronged and smoky. He sighed with pleasure, almost nestled in the human clot, the way a cat nestles into a woodpile. He ordered whiskey and drank it and felt warm and good. He didn't see or hear. He simply absorbed the contact. As it grew late and the men began to drift away, he became fearful of the time when he would have to go home. Soon he was alone with a bartender, who was rubbing and rubbing the mahogany of the bar and trying with his eyes and his manner to get Adam to go.
"I'll have one more," Adam said.
The bartender set the bottle out. Adam noticed him for the first time. He had a strawberry mark on his forehead.
"I'm a stranger in these parts," said Adam.
"That's what we mostly get at the falls," the bartender said.
"I've been in the army, cavalry."
"Yeah," the bartender said. Adam felt suddenly that he had to impress this man, had to get under his skin some way.
"Fighting Indians," he said. "Had some great times."
The man didn't answer him.
"My brother has a mark on his head."
The bartender touched the strawberry mark with his fingers. "Birthmark," he said. "Gets bigger every year. Your brother got one."
"His came from a cut. He wrote me about it."
"You notice this one of mine looks like a cat?"
"Sure it does."
"That's my nickname, Cat. Had it all my life. They say my old lady must have been scared by a cat when she was having me."
"I'm on my way home. Been away a long time. Won't you have a drink?"
"Thanks. Where are you staying?"
"Mrs. May's boarding house."
"I know her. What they tell is she fills you up with soup so you can't eat much meat."
"I guess there are tricks to every trade," said Adam.
"I guess that's right. There's sure plenty in mine."
"I bet that's true," said Adam.
"But the one trick I need, I haven't got. I wish I knew that one."
"What is it?"
"How the hell to get you to go home and let me close up?"
Adam stared at him, and didn't speak.
"It's a joke," the bartender said uneasily.
"I guess I'll go home in the morning," said Adam. "I mean, my real home."
"Good luck," the bartender said. Adam walked through the dark town, increasing his speed as though his loneliness sniffed along behind him. The sagging front steps of his boarding house creaked a warning as he climbed them. The hall was gloomed with the dot of yellow light from an oil lamp, turned down so low that it jerked expiringly. The landlady stood in her open doorway, and her nose made a shadow to the bottom of her chin. Her cold eyes followed Adam, as do the eyes of a front-painted portrait, and she listened with her nose for the whiskey that was in him.
"Good night," said Adam. She didn't answer him.
At the top of the first flight, he looked back. Her head was raised, and now her chin made a shadow on her throat, and her eyes had no pupils. His room smelled of dust, dampened and dried many times. He picked a match from his block and scratched it on the side of the block. He lighted the shank of candle in the japanned candlestick and regarded the bed, as spineless as a hammock and covered with a dirty patchwork quilt, the cotton batting spilling from the edges. The porch steps complained again, and Adam knew the woman would be standing in her doorway, ready to spray inhospitality on the new arrival. Adam sat down in a straight chair and put his elbows on his knees and supported his chin in his hands. A rumor down the hall began a patient, continuing cough against the quiet night. And Adam knew he could not go home. He had heard old soldiers tell of doing what he was going to do. "I just couldn't stand it. Didn't have no place to go, didn't know nobody. Wandered around, and pretty soon I got in a panic like a kid. And the first thing I knowed, I'm begging the sergeant to let me back in, like he was doing me a favor." Back in Chicago, Adam re-enlisted and asked to be assigned to his old regiment. On the train going west, the men of his squadron seemed very dear and desirable. While he waited to change trains in Kansas City, he heard his name called, and a message was shoved into his hand, orders to report to Washington, to the office of the Secretary of War. Adam, in his 5 years, had absorbed, rather than learned, never to wonder about an order. To an enlisted man, the high, far gods in Washington were crazy, and if a soldier wanted to keep his sanity, he thought about generals as little as possible. In due course, Adam gave his name to a clerk and went to sit in an anteroom. His father found him there. It took Adam a moment to recognize Cyrus, and much longer to get used to him. Cyrus had become a great man. He dressed like a great man. Black broadcloth coat and trousers, wide black hat, overcoat with a velvet collar, ebony cane, which he made to seem a sword. And Cyrus conducted himself like a great man. His speech was slow and mellow, measured and unexcited. His gestures were wide, and new teeth gave him a vulpine smile out of all proportion to his emotion. After Adam had realized that this was his father, he was still puzzled. Suddenly he looked down. No wooden leg. The leg was straight, bent at the knee, and the foot was clad in a polished kid Congress gaiter. When he moved, there was a limp, but not a clumping, wooden-legged limp. Cyrus saw the look. "Mechanical," he said. "Works on a hinge. Got a spring. Don't even limp when I set my mind to it. I'll show it to you when I take it off. Come along with me." Adam said, "I'm under orders, sir. I'm to report to Colonel Wells." "I know you are. I told Wells to issue the orders. Come along." Adam said uneasily, "If you don't mind, sir, I think I'd better report to Colonel Wells." His father reversed himself. "I was testing you," he said grandly. "I wanted to see whether the Army has any discipline these days. Good boy. I knew it would be good for you. You're a man and a soldier, my boy."
"I'm under orders, sir," said Adam. This man was a stranger to him. A faint distaste arose in Adam. Something wasn't true. And the speed with which doors opened straight to the colonel, the obsequious respect of that officer, the words, "The secretary will see you now, sir," didn't remove Adam's feeling.
"This is my son, a private soldier, Mr. Secretary, just as I was, a private soldier in the United States Army."
I was discharged a corporal, sir, said Adam. He hardly heard the exchange of compliments. He was thinking, this is the Secretary of War. Can't he see that this isn't the way my father is? He's play-acting. What's happened to him? It's funny the Secretary can't see it.
They walked to the small hotel where Cyrus lived, and on the way Cyrus pointed out the sights, the buildings, the spots of history with the expansiveness of a lecturer.
I live in a hotel, he said. I thought of getting a house, but I'm on the move so much it wouldn't hardly pay. I'm all over the country most of the time.
The hotel clerk couldn't see it either. He bowed to Cyrus, called him senator, and indicated that he would give Adam a room if he had to throw someone out.
Send a bottle of whiskey to my room, please.
I can send some chipped ice if you like.
Ice, said Cyrus. My son is a soldier.
He rapped his leg with his stick, and it gave forth a hollow sound.
I have been a soldier, a private soldier. What do we want ice for?
Adam was amazed at Cyrus's accommodations. He had not only a bedroom, but a sitting room beside it, and the toilet was in a closet right in the bedroom.
Cyrus sat down in a deep chair and sighed. He pulled up his trouser leg, and Adam saw the contraption of iron and leather and hard wood. Cyrus unlaced the leather sheath that held it on his stump and stood the travesty on flesh beside his chair.
It gets to pinching pretty bad, he said.
With the leg off, his father became himself again, the self Adam remembered. He had experienced the beginning of contempt, but now the childhood fear and respect and animosity came back to him, so that he seemed a little boy testing his father's immediate mood to escape trouble. Cyrus made his preparations, drank his whiskey, and loosened his collar. He faced Adam.
Well?
Sir?
Why did you reenlist?
I don't know, sir. I just wanted to.
You don't like the Army, Adam?
No, sir.
Why did you go back?
I didn't want to go home. Cyrus sighed and rubbed the tips of his fingers on the arms of his chair.
Are you going to stay in the Army?
He asked. I don't know, sir.
I can get you into West Point. I have influence. I can get you discharged so you can enter West Point.
I don't want to go there.
Are you defying me? Cyrus asked quietly.
Adam took a long time to answer, and his mind sought escape before he said, Yes, sir.
Cyrus said, Pour me some whiskey, son. And when he had it, he continued, I wonder if you know how much influence I really have. I can throw the Grand Army at any candidate like a sock. Even the president likes to know what I think about public matters. I can get senators defeated, and I can pick appointments like apples. I can make men, and I can destroy men. Do you know that?
Adam knew more than that. He knew that Cyrus was defending himself with threats.
Yes, sir, I've heard. I could get you assigned to Washington, assigned to me even, teach you your way about.
I'd rather go back to my regiment, sir. He saw the shadow of loss darken his father's face.
Maybe I made a mistake. You've learned the dumb resistance of a soldier. He sighed. I'll get you ordered to your regiment. You'll rot in barracks.
Thank you, sir.
After a pause, Adam asked, Why don't you bring Charles here? Because I... No, Charles is better where he is. Better where he is.
Adam remembered his father's tone and how he looked. And he had plenty of time to remember, because he did rot in barracks. He remembered that Cyrus was lonely and alone and knew it. Charles had looked forward to Adam's return after 5 years. He had painted the house and the barn, and as the time approached, he had a woman in to clean the house, to clean it to the bone. She was a clean, mean old woman. She looked at the dust-gray, rotting curtains, threw them out, and made new ones. She dug grease out of the stove that had been there since Charles's mother died. And she leached the walls of a brown, shiny nastiness deposited by cooking fat and kerosene lamps. She pickled the floors with lye, soaked the blankets in Sal's soda, complaining the whole time to herself, "Men, dirty animals. Pigs is clean, compared. Rotten their own juice. Don't see how no woman ever marries 'em. Stink like measles. Look at oven. Pie juice from Methuselah." Charles had moved into a shed where his nostrils wouldn't be assailed by the immaculate but painful smells of lye and soda and ammonia and yellow soap. He did, however, get the impression that she didn't approve of his housekeeping. When finally she grumbled away from the shining house, Charles remained in the shed. He wanted to keep the house clean for Adam. In the shed where he slept were the tools of the farm and the tools for their repair and maintenance. Charles found that he could cook his fried and boiled meals more quickly and efficiently on the forge than he could on the kitchen stove. The bellows forced quick, flaring heat from the coke. A man didn't have to wait for a stove to heat up. He wondered why he had never thought of it before. Charles waited for Adam, and Adam did not come. Perhaps Adam was ashamed to write. It was Cyrus who told Charles in an angry letter about Adam's reenlistment against his wishes. And Cyrus indicated that, in some future, Charles could visit him in Washington. But he never asked him again. Charles moved back to the house and lived in a kind of savage filth, taking a satisfaction in overcoming the work of the grumbling woman. It was over a year before Adam wrote to Charles, a letter of embarrassed newsiness, building his courage to say, "I don't know why I signed again. It was like somebody else doing it. Write soon and tell me how you are." Charles didn't reply until he had received 4 anxious letters, and then he replied coolly, "I didn't hardly expect you anyway." And he went on with a detailed account of farm and animals. Time had got in its work. After that, Charles wrote right after New Year's and received a letter from Adam written right after New Year's. They had grown so apart that there was little mutual reference and no questions. Charles began to keep one slovenly woman after another. When they got on his nerves, he threw them out the way he would sell a pig. He didn't like them and had no interest in whether or not they liked him. He grew away from the village. His contacts were only with the inn and the postmaster. The village people might denounce his manner of life, but one thing he had which balanced his ugly life, even in their eyes. The farm had never been so well run. Charles cleared land, built up his walls, improved his drainage, and added 100 acres to the farm. More than that, he was planting tobacco, and a long new tobacco barn stood impressively behind the house. For these things, he kept the respect of his neighbors. A farmer can't think too much evil of a good farmer. Charles was spending most of his money and all of his energy on the farm.
This ends Disc 2. East of Eden, Disc 3.
Chapter 7. Adam spent his next 5 years doing the things an army uses to keep its men from going insane. Endless polishing of metal and leather, parade and drill and escort, ceremony of bugle and flag, a ballet of business for men who aren't doing anything. In 1886, the big packing house strike broke out in Chicago, and Adam's regiment entrained, but the strike was settled before they were needed. In 1888, the Seminoles, who had never signed a peace treaty, stirred restlessly, and the cavalry entrained again. But the Seminoles retired into their swamps and were quiet, and the dreamlike routine settled on the troops again. Time interval is a strange and contradictory matter in the mind. It would be reasonable to suppose that a routine time or an eventless time would seem interminable. It should be so, but it isn't. It is the dull, eventless times that have no duration whatever. A time splashed with interest, wounded with tragedy, creviced with joy, that's the time that seems long in the memory. And this is right when you think about it. Eventlessness has no posts to drape duration on. From nothing to nothing is no time at all. Adam's second 5 years were up before he knew it. It was late in 1890, and he was discharged with sergeant stripes in the Presidio in San Francisco. Letters between Charles and Adam had become great rarities, but Adam wrote his brother just before his discharge. "This time I'm coming home." And that was the last Charles heard of him for over 3 years. Adam waited out the winter, wandering up the river to Sacramento, ranging in the valley of the San Joaquin, and when the spring came, Adam had no money. He rolled a blanket and started slowly eastward, sometimes walking and sometimes with groups of men on the rods under slow-moving freight cars. At night, he jungled up with wandering men in the camping places on the fringes of towns. He learned to beg, not for money, but for food. And before he knew it, he was a bindle-stiff himself. Such men are rare now, but in the 90s there were many of them, wandering men, lonely men who wanted it that way. Some of them ran from responsibilities, and some felt driven out of society by injustice. They worked a little, but not for long. They stole a little, but only food and occasionally needed garments from a wash line. They were all kinds of men, literate men and ignorant men, clean men and dirty men, but all of them had restlessness in common. They followed warmth and avoided great heat and great cold. As the spring advanced, they tracked it eastward, and the first frost drove them west and south. They were brothers to the coyote, which, being wild, lives close to man and his chicken yards. They were near towns, but not in them. Associations with other men were for a week or for a day, and then they drifted apart. Around the little fires where communal stew bubbled, there was all manner of talk, and only the personal was unmentionable. Adam heard of the development of the IWW with its angry angels. He listened to philosophic discussions, to metaphysics, to aesthetics, to impersonal experience. His companions for the night might be a murderer, an unfrocked priest, or one who had unfrocked himself, a professor forced from his warm berth by a dull faculty, a lone-driven man running from memory, a fallen archangel, and a devil in training. And each contributed bits of thought to the fire, as each contributed carrots and potatoes and onions and meat to the stew. He learned the technique of shaving with broken glass, of judging a house before knocking to ask for a handout. He learned to avoid or get along with hostile police, and to evaluate a woman for her warmth of heart. Adam took pleasure in the new life. When autumn touched the trees, he had got as far as Omaha. And without question or reason or thought, he hurried west and south, fled through the mountains, and arrived with relief in Southern California. He wandered by the sea from the border north as far as San Luis Obispo, and he learned to pilfer the tide pools for abalones and eels and mussels and perch, to dig sandbars for clams, and to trap a rabbit in the dunes with a noose of fish line. And he lay in the sun-warmed sand, counting the waves. Spring urged him east again, but more slowly than before. Summer was cool in the mountains, and the mountain people were kind as lonesome people are kind. Adam took a job on a widow's outfit near Denver and shared her table and her bed humbly until the frost drove him south again. He followed the Rio Grande past Albuquerque and El Paso, through the Big Bend, through Laredo to Brownsville. He learned Spanish words for food and pleasure, and he learned that when people are very poor, they still have something to give and the impulse to give it. He developed a love for poor people he could not have conceived if he had not been poor himself. And by now he was an expert tramp, using humility as a working principle. He was lean and sun-darkened, and he could withdraw his own personality until he made no stir of anger or jealousy. His voice had grown soft, and he had merged many accents and dialects into his own speech, so that his speech did not seem foreign anywhere. This was the great safety of the tramp, a protective veil. He rode the trains very infrequently, for there was a growing anger against tramps based on the angry violence of the IWW and aggravated by the fierce reprisals against them. Adam was picked up for vagrancy. The quick brutality of police and prisoners frightened him and drove him away from the gatherings of tramps. He traveled alone after that and made sure he was shaven and clean. When spring came again, he started north. He felt that his time of rest and peace was over. He aimed north toward Charles and the weakening memories of his childhood. Adam moved rapidly across interminable East Texas, through Louisiana and the butt ends of Mississippi and Alabama, and into the flank of Florida. He felt that he had to move quickly. The Negroes were poor enough to be kind, but they couldn't trust any white man, no matter how poor. And the poor white men had a fear of strangers. Near Tallahassee, he was picked up by sheriff's men, judged vagrant, and put on a road gang. That's how the roads were built. His sentence was 6 months. He was released and instantly picked up again for a second 6 months. And now he learned how men can consider other men as beasts, and that the easiest way to get along with such men was to be a beast. A clean face, an open face, an eye raised to meet an eye, these drew attention, and attention drawn brought punishment. Adam thought how a man doing an ugly or a brutal thing has hurt himself and must punish someone for the hurt. To be guarded at work by men with shotguns, to be shackled by the ankle at night to a chain, were simple matters of precaution. But the savage whippings for the least stir of will, for the smallest shred of dignity or resistance, these seemed to indicate that guards were afraid of prisoners. And Adam knew from his years in the army that a man afraid is a dangerous animal. And Adam, like anyone in the world, feared what whipping would do to his body and his spirit. He drew a curtain around himself. He removed expression from his face, light from his eyes, and silenced his speech. Later, he was not so much astonished that it had happened to him, but that he had been able to take it, and with a minimum of pain. It was much more horrible afterward than when it was happening. It's a triumph of self-control to see a man whipped until the muscles of his back show white and glistening through the cuts, and to give no sign of pity or anger or interest. And Adam learned this. People are felt rather than seen after the first few moments. During his second sentence on the roads of Florida, Adam reduced his personality to a minus. He caused no stir, put out no vibration, became as nearly invisible as it is possible to be. And when the guards couldn't feel him, they weren't afraid of him. They gave him the job of cleaning the camps, of handing out the slops to the prisoners, of filling the water buckets. Adam waited until 3 days before his second release. Right after noon that day, he filled the water buckets and went back to the little river for more. He filled his buckets with stones and sank them. And then he eased himself into the water and swam a long way downstream, rested, and swam farther down. He kept moving in the water until at dusk he found a place under a bank with bushes for cover. He didn't get out of the water. Late in the night, he heard the hounds go by, covering both sides of the river. He had rubbed his hair hard with green leaves to cover human odor. He sat in the water with his nose and eyes clear. In the morning, the hounds came back, disinterested, and the men were too tired to beat the banks properly. When they were gone, Adam dug a piece of waterlogged fried sawbelly out of his pocket and ate it. He had schooled himself against hurry. Most men were caught bolting. It took Adam 5 days to cross the short distance into Georgia. He took no chances, held back his impatience with an iron control. He was astonished at his ability. On the edge of Valdosta, Georgia, he lay hidden until long after midnight, and he entered the town like a shadow, crept to the rear of a cheap store, forced a window slowly so that the screws of the lock were pulled from the sun-rotted wood. Then he replaced the lock but left the window open. He had to work by moonlight drifting through dirty windows. He stole a pair of cheap trousers, a white shirt, black shoes, black hat, and an oilskin raincoat. And he tried on each article for fit. He forced himself to make sure nothing looked disturbed before he climbed out the window. He had taken nothing which was not heavily stocked. He had not even looked for the cash drawer. He lowered the window carefully and slipped from shadow to shadow in the moonlight. He lay hidden during the day and went in search of food at night. Turnips, a few ears of corn from a crib, a few windfall apples, nothing that would be missed. He broke the newness of the shoes with rubbed sand and kneaded the raincoat to destroy its newness. It was 3 days before he got the rain he needed, or in his extreme caution, felt he needed. The rain started late in the afternoon. Adam huddled under his oilskin, waiting for the dark to come. And when it did, he walked through the dripping night into the town of Valdosta. His black hat was pulled down over his eyes, and his yellow oilskin was strapped tight against his throat. He made his way to the station and peered through a rain-blurred window. The station agent, in green eyeshade and black alpaca work sleeves, leaned through the ticket window, talking to a friend. It was 20 minutes before the friend went away. Adam watched him off the platform. He took a deep breath to calm himself and went inside. Charles received very few letters. Sometimes he didn't inquire at the post office for weeks. In February of 1894, when a thick letter came from a firm of attorneys in Washington, the postmaster thought it might be important. He walked out to the Trask farm, found Charles cutting wood, and gave him the letter. And since he had taken so much trouble, he waited around to hear what the letter said. Charles let him wait. Very slowly he read all 5 pages, went back and read them again, moving his lips over the words. Then he folded it up and turned toward the house. The postmaster called after him. "Anything wrong, Mr. Trask?" "My father is dead," Charles said, and he walked into the house and closed the door. "Took it hard," the postmaster reported in town. "Took it real hard. Quiet, man. Don't talk much." In the house, Charles lighted the lamp, although it was not dark yet. He laid the letter on the table, and he washed his hands before he sat down to read it again. There hadn't been anyone to send him a telegram. The attorneys had found his address among his father's papers. They were sorry, offered their condolences. And they were pretty excited, too. When they had made Trask's will, they thought he might have a few $100s to leave his sons. That is what he looked to be worth. When they inspected his bank books, they found that he had over $93,000 in the bank and $10,000 in good securities. They felt very different about Mr. Trask then. People with that much money were rich. They would never have to worry. It was enough to start a dynasty. The lawyers congratulated Charles and his brother Adam. Under the will, they said, it was to be shared equally. After the money, they listed the personal effects left by the deceased. 5 ceremonial swords presented to Cyrus at various GAR conventions. An olive wood gavel with a gold plate on it. A Masonic watch charm with a diamond set in the dividers. The gold caps from the teeth he had out when he got his plates. Watch, silver. Gold-headed stick, and so forth. Charles read the letter twice more and cupped his forehead in his hands. He wondered about Adam. He wanted Adam home. Charles felt puzzled and dull. He built up the fire and put the frying pan to heat and sliced thick pieces of salt pork into it. Then he went back to stare at the letter. Suddenly he picked it up and put it in the drawer of the kitchen table. He decided not to think of the matter at all for a while. Of course, he thought of little else, but it was a dull, circular thinking that came back to the starting point again and again. Where had he gotten it? When two events have something in common, in their natures or in time or place, we leap happily to the conclusion that they are similar. And from this tendency, we create magics and store them for retelling. Charles had never before had a letter delivered at the farm in his life. Some weeks later, a boy ran out to the farm with a telegram. Charles always connected the letter and the telegram the way we group 2 deaths and anticipate a 3rd. He hurried to the village railroad station, carrying the telegram in his hand. "Listen to this," he said to the operator. "I already read it."
"You did?"
"It comes over the wire," said the operator. "I wrote it down."
"Oh, yes, sure. Urgent. Need you telegraph me $100. Coming home. Adam."
"Came collect," the operator said. "You owe me 60 cents.
Valdosta, Georgia. I never heard of it."
"Neither did I, but it's there."
"Say, Carlton, how do you go about telegraphing money?"
"Well, you bring me $102.60, and I send a wire telling the Valdosta operator to pay Adam $100. You owe me 60 cents, too."
"I'll pay. Say, how do I know it's Adam? What's to stop anybody from collecting it?"
The operator permitted himself a smile of worldliness. "Way we go about it, you give me a question couldn't nobody else know the answer. So I send both the question and the answer. Operator asks this fellow the question, and if he can't answer, he don't get the money."
"Say, that's pretty cute. I better think up a good one."
"You better get the $100 while old Breen still got the window open." Charles was delighted with the game. He came back with the money in his hand.
"I got the question," he said.
"I hope it ain't your mother's middle name. A lot of people don't remember."
"No, nothing like that. It's this. What did you give Father on his birthday, just before you went in the army?"
"It's a good question, but it's long as hell. Can't you cut it down to 10 words?
"Who's paying for it?"
"Answer is, a pup."
"Wouldn't nobody guess that," said Carlton.
"Well, it's you paying, not me."
"Be funny if he forgot," said Charles. "He would never get home."
Adam came walking out from the village. His shirt was dirty, and the stolen clothes were wrinkled and soiled from having been slept in for a week. Between the house and the barn, he stopped and listened for his brother. And in a moment he heard him hammering at something in the big new tobacco barn.
"Oh, Charles!" Adam called.
The hammering stopped, and there was silence. Adam felt as though his brother were inspecting him through the cracks in the barn. Then Charles came out quickly and hurried to Adam and shook hands.
"How are you?"
"Fine," said Adam.
"Good God, you're thin."
"I guess I am. And I'm years older, too."
Charles inspected him from head to foot. You don't look prosperous.
I'm not.
Where's your valise?
I haven't got one.
Jesus Christ, where have you been?
Mostly wandering around all over.
Like a hobo?
Like a hobo.
After all the years and the life that had made creased leather out of Charles's skin and redness in his dark eyes, Adam knew from remembering that Charles was thinking of two things, the questions and something else.
Why didn't you come home?
I just got to wandering. Couldn't stop. It gets into you. It's a real bad scar you've got there.
That's the one I wrote you about. Gets worse all the time.
Why didn't you write?
Are you hungry?
Charles's hands itched into his pockets and out and touched his chin and scratched his head.
It may go away. I saw a man once, bartender. He had one that looked like a cat. It was a birthmark. His nickname was Cat.
Are you hungry?
Sure, I guess I am.
Plan to stay home now?
I guess so.
Do you want to get to it now?
I guess so,
Charles echoed him. Our father is dead.
I know.
How the hell do you know?
Station agent told me.
How long ago did he die?
About a month.
What of?
Pneumonia.
Buried here?
No. In Washington. I got a letter in newspapers. Carried him on a caisson with a flag over it. The vice president was there, and the president sent a wreath. All in the papers. Pictures, too. I'll show you. I've got it all.
Adam studied his brother's face until Charles looked away.
Are you mad at something?
Adam asked.
What should I be mad at? It just sounded... I've got nothing to be mad at. Come on, I'll get you something to eat.
All right.
Did he linger long?
No, it was galloping pneumonia. Went right out. Charles was covering up something. He wanted to tell it, but he didn't know how to go about it. He kept hiding in words. Adam fell silent. It might be a good thing to be quiet and let Charles sniff and circle until he came out with it.
I don't take much stock in messages from the beyond, said Charles.
Still, how can you know? Some people claim they've had messages. Old Sarah Whitburn, she swore. You just don't know what to think.
You didn't get a message, did you?
Say, what the hell's bit off your tongue?
Adam said, just thinking.
And he was thinking with amazement. Why, I am not afraid of my brother. I used to be scared to death of him, and I'm not anymore.
Wonder why not?
Could it be the army? Or the chain gang? Could it be father's death?
Maybe, but I don't understand it.
With a lack of fear, he knew he could say anything he wanted to, whereas before he had picked over his words to avoid trouble. It was a good feeling he had, almost as though he himself had been dead and resurrected. They walked into the kitchen he remembered and didn't remember. It seemed smaller and dingier. Adam said almost gaily,
Charles, I've been listening. You want to tell me something, and you're walking around it like a terrier around a bush. You better tell me before it bites you.
Charles's eyes sparked up with anger. He raised his head. His force was gone. He thought with desolation, I can't lick him anymore. I can't. Adam chuckled.
Maybe it's wrong to feel good when our father's just died, but you know, Charles, I never felt better in my whole life. I never felt as good.
Spill it, Charles. Don't let it chew on you. Charles asked,
Did you love our father? I won't answer you until I know what you're getting at. Did you or didn't you? What's that got to do with you? Tell me. The creative, free boldness was all through Adam's bones and brain. All right, I'll tell you. No, I didn't. Sometimes he scared me. Sometimes I admired him. But most of the time I hated him. Now tell me why you want to know. Charles was looking down at his hands. I don't understand, he said. I just can't get it through my head. He loved you more than anything in the world. I don't believe that. You don't have to. He liked everything you brought him. He didn't like me. He didn't like anything I gave him. Remember the present I gave him, the pocket knife? I cut and sold a load of wood to get that knife. Well, he didn't even take it to Washington with him. It's right in his bureau right now. And you gave him a pup. It didn't cost you a thing. Well, I'll show you a picture of that pup. It was at his funeral. A colonel was holding it. It was blind, couldn't walk. They shot it after the funeral. Adam was puzzled at the fierceness of his brother's tone. I don't see, he said. I don't see what you're getting at. I loved him, said Charles. And for the first time that Adam could remember, Charles began to cry. He put his head down in his arms and cried. Adam was about to go to him when a little of the old fear came back. No, he thought. If I touched him, he would try to kill me. He went to the open doorway and stood looking out, and he could hear his brothers sniffling behind him. It wasn't a pretty farm near the house. Never had been. There was litter about it, an unkemptness, a rundownness, a lack of plan. No flowers, and bits of paper and scraps of wood scattered about on the ground. The house wasn't pretty either. It was a well-built shanty for shelter and cooking. It was a grim farm and a grim house, unloved and unloving. It was no home, no place to long for or to come back to. Suddenly Adam thought of his stepmother, as unloved as the farm. Adequate, clean in her way, but no more wife than the farm was a home. His brother's sobbing had stopped. Adam turned. Charles was looking blankly straight ahead. Adam said, "Tell me about Mother." "She died, I wrote you. Tell me about her." "I told you, she died. It's so long ago. She wasn't your mother." The smile Adam had once caught on her face flashed up in his mind. Her face was projected in front of him. Charles's voice came through the image and exploded it. "Will you tell me one thing? Not quick. Think before you tell me. And maybe don't answer unless it's true, your answer." Charles moved his lips to form the question in advance. "Do you think it would be possible for our father to be dishonest?" "What do you mean?" "Isn't that plain enough? I said it plain. There's only one meaning to dishonest." "I don't know," said Adam. "I don't know. No one ever said it. Look what he got to be. Stayed overnight in the White House. The vice president came to his funeral. Does that sound like a dishonest man?" "Come on, Charles," he begged. "Tell me what you've been wanting to tell me from the minute I got here." Charles wet his lips. The blood seemed to have gone out of him, and with it, energy and all ferocity. His voice became a monotone. "Father made a will. Left everything equal to me and you." Adam laughed. "Well, we can always live on the farm. I guess we won't starve." "It's over $100,000, the voice went on. "You're crazy. More like $100. Where would he get it?" "It's no mistake. His salary with the GAR was $135 a month. He paid his own room and board. He got 5 cents a mile and hotel expenses when he traveled." Maybe he had it all the time and we never knew. No, he didn't have it all the time.
Well, why don't we write to the GAR and ask? Someone there might know.
I wouldn't dare, said Charles.
Now look, don't go off half-cocked. There's such a thing as speculation. Lots of men struck it rich. He knew big men. Maybe he got in on a good thing. Think of the men who went to the gold rush in California and came back rich.
Charles's face was desolate. His voice dropped so that Adam had to lean close to hear. It was as toneless as a report.
Our father went into the Union Army in June 1862. He had 3 months training here in this state. That makes it September. He marched south. October 12th, he was hit in the leg and sent to the hospital. He came home in January.
I don't see what you're getting at.
Charles's words were thin and sallow. He was not at Chancellorsville. He was not at Gettysburg, or the Wilderness, or Richmond, or Appomattox.
How do you know?
His discharge. It came down with his other papers.
Adam sighed deeply. In his chest, like beating fists, was a surge of joy. He shook his head almost in disbelief.
Charles said, "How did he get away with it? How in hell did he get away with it? Nobody ever questioned it. Did you? Did I? Did my mother? Nobody did. Not even in Washington."
Adam stood up. "What's in the house to eat? I'm going to warm up something."
"I killed a chicken last night. I'll fry it if you can wait."
"Anything quick?"
"Some salt pork and plenty of eggs."
"I'll have that," said Adam.
They left the question lying there, walked mentally around it, stepped over it. Their words ignored it, but their minds never left it. They wanted to talk about it and couldn't. Charles fried salt pork, warmed up a skillet of beans, fried eggs.
"I plowed the pasture," he said, "put it in rye."
"How did it do?"
"Just fine once I got the rocks out." He touched his forehead. "I got this damn thing trying to pry out a stone."
"You wrote about that," Adam said. "Don't know whether I told you, your letters meant a lot to me."
"You never wrote much what you were doing," said Charles.
"I guess I didn't want to think about it. It was pretty bad, most of it."
"I read about the campaigns in the papers. Did you go on those?"
"Yes. I didn't want to think about them. Still don't."
"Did you kill Injuns?"
"Yes, we killed Injuns."
"I guess they're real ornery."
"I guess so."
"You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to."
"I don't want to."
They ate their dinner under the kerosene lamp. "We'd get more light if I'd only get around to washing that lampshade."
"I'll do it," said Adam. "It's hard to think of everything."
"It's going to be fine having you back. How'd you like to go to the inn after supper?"
"Well, we'll see. Maybe I'd like just to sit a while.
I didn't write about it in a letter, but they've got girls at the inn. I didn't know but you'd like to go in with me. They change every 2 weeks. I didn't know but you'd like to look them over."
"Girls?"
"Yes, they're upstairs. Makes it pretty handy. And I thought you just coming home."
"Not tonight. Maybe later."
"How much do they charge?"
"A dollar.
Pretty nice girls, mostly."
"Maybe later," said Adam.
"I'm surprised they let them come in."
"I was too at first, but they worked out a system."
"You go often?"
"Every 2 or 3 weeks. It's pretty lonesome here, a man living alone."
"You wrote once you were thinking of getting married."
"Well, I was. Guess I didn't find the right girl."
All around the main subject, the brothers beat. Now and then they would almost step into it and quickly pull away, back into crops and local gossip and politics and health. They knew they would come back to it sooner or later. Charles was more anxious to strike in deep than Adam was.
But then Charles had had the time to think of it, and to Adam it was a new field of thinking and feeling. He would have preferred to put it over until another day.